And away we go!
Eventually Supertrain, episode 165. This is a podcast dedicated to short-lived TV shows, episode-by-episode discussion of shows that never got enough love. Eventually, we will cover Supertrain. I'm your main host, Daniel R. Budnick. Call me Dan. How are you, everybody? I hope all is well. We are back to three shows now. Well, we've been back. We were back last episode. But for a time, we were only doing two, and things were a little weird. I know. But we're back. Everything, I think, is okay again. So we are starting off this episode with the great Tim S. Turner and myself discussing season 2, episode 2, or episode 8 of Max Headroom. Then the great Stan Peel and I are discussing the third episode as broadcast of Partners in Crime with Linda Carter and Lonnie Anderson. And then, sadly, I am talking the final, the 13th and final episode, Albert Alberta, of Monster Squad. Yes, we say goodbye to Monster Squad on this episode, and that's sad. But in the next episode, we'll start a brand new old show. And we'll have a guest host on that I know y'all love, so that's happy. So let's be diving in, shall we, to some Max Headroom. Max Headroom, Episode 8, Season 2, Episode 2, Deities, directed by Thomas J. Wright, written by Michael Casalt. Original air date was September 25th, 1987. As I have done before, I am going to read you the description from Wikipedia. Thank you, Wikipedia. Because, not that this episode is terribly complicated, but I don't want to get bogged down in it. So here we go. Vanna Smith, the leader of View Age Church, who happens to be Carter's ex-girlfriend, kidnaps Max from Network 23 and threatens to erase him to prevent Carter from running a story exposing the church's false claim of saving its parishioners' minds as AI constructs for a future resurrection. The constructs are inferior pictures that only say a few phrases. But just how did Max get kidnapped easily? Deities. Max Headroom, Season 2, Episode 2, Episode 8 overall, and I am here with Tim S. Turner. Tim, how are you? For real, how are you?
Yes, it's wonderful, isn't it?
I was going to do that. Yes, it's wonderful. Oh, for fun. Now, let's dive right in. Deities, what did you think of it? You were a little underwhelmed by the season opener last time, but what did you think of this one?
Yeah, this one and the following episode are my two favorite ones of the series.
What?
So, yeah.
Tell me more. Or you can stop there.
I don't know. This one, there was something that was really interesting about it, because we get a little more, again, of Edison's past, because we really don't know a lot about it. So obviously this woman is someone he's investigating, someone he's had a relationship with in the past. And, it makes you wonder, I don't know. It's funny because I don't really think that they necessarily have this great chemistry, but somehow apparently they did. But, I mean, she's beautiful. Don't get me wrong. I don't know. There was something about this one that really rang true for me. I really enjoyed it, and maybe it's because it was, kind of a rant against televangelist stuff.
Yeah, I gotta say, yeah, I also enjoyed the episode. I think I like the fact that we do get more of Edison. I like the fact that we see this this great sort of televangelical this world. I like this space. It's very much of the time, but I think it's also very much of you can see it now too. And I love just the people just, you know, the moment the church there brings up, you know, the resurrection and, you know, bringing everyone back. All these people are on board and they're watching these goofball images of their loved ones on TV say, yes, it's wonderful, and things like that. I thought that was a joy because, like, even the people in charge of the church know that that's a bit of a jip, but the people don't care.
Yeah.
The people are, like the old lady in the beginning, she doesn't care. Yeah, I like it in the background on Edison and when he meets, is it Vanna Smith, I believe? Is that her name?
Yes.
Okay, I like that because it's not quite Vanna White. You know, Vanna White is a fun first name, a generic last name. This is like that too. It's Vanna again. And of course, I would think at 87, 88, you would think Vanna White, right? If you heard Vanna, the first thing you'd think would be Vanna White. But this is a different kind of Vanna. And one of the things I like about Vanna Smith is she is beautiful, but she's got a voice that sometimes I can't tell where it's coming from. Occasionally,
you get kind of like a sense that like a lot of her stuff might be ADR'd. I don't know.
Yes, yeah. For some reason, it's like there are occasional moments where I thought, oh, Dan, you're over analyzing it. But then there are some moments when she's talking to Edison where her voice doesn't sound like it's in the same room as her body. Maybe that's why he liked her.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like some crazy ventriloquism right there, right? The thought that maybe there's a woman in another room doing her voice.
Like it was a Oz.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So, overall, I think it's a good episode. I like the fact that Max is actually an integral part of it.
Yes.
I like the fact that it's about Edison almost losing Max because he's so interested in his integrity. Right. And I like the fact too that the last episode, the climax was just basically a few people talking, which I know a lot of you are saying, like, come on, man. You know, I like my endings of everything have to be 30 minutes of people fighting, heavy CGI, and lots of rays shooting out of people's hands. And I don't know what they mean, but they mean something, right?
Explosions,
you know, but a good chatting. We consider this here to be Max chat. This is one big climax, as it were, when Tim and I are talking to you. Enjoy that. But I like the fact that in this one, I think the ending in this one is basically Max and Edison talking to Vanna, and Vanna's the second in command guy there, just trying to convince them to not shut Max down. And it goes right up to the wire, and it's nicely done, and it's well written, and it's well acted, and it's suspenseful, and you don't think you're going to lose Max. Part of the fun in the end being when Bryce basically says, "Well, if Max didn't want to go, he wouldn't have gone." So,
right.
So I kind of like that fun little thing that Max is just kind of doing that, just to have some fun, to relieve some boredom, maybe to test Edison. I don't know, but we still don't really know much about Max, but we know he knows all about Edison, which is fun when Theora and Murray are trying to get info about Vanna, and Max is kind of giving them little bits of stuff. But overall, I think I like the premise behind the episode. I like the way they carry it out. And I love the fact that we get some background for Edison. Previous one, we got background for Bryce. Now we get background for Edison. But I think overall, this is just a sharper episode. I think there's more going on in this episode. Like we said, the previous one, there really isn't much going on. Because you know immediately, like, it's one of those kids is doing it. And you're pretty sure that they're not going to kill Blank Reg. So it's kind of just like moving from one end to the other. But this one, there's more to it. There's more, you know, there's more sort of meat, as it were. Or if you don't eat meat, like some sort of veggie soy stuff to the plot.
It works. I think it's interesting in this episode with Max, you kind of almost get like a like Max as puppet master kind of thing out of it. Cause like, you know, you're like, oh no, are they going to destroy Max? But really it kind of seems almost at the end, you're like, wait a minute. Was Max maybe really controlling everything? Cause he wanted to kind of just like see, what would happen if he reconnected Edison and Vanna.
Yeah.
you know, like crossing wires and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I did like they had little bits and pieces in there, like the fact that the 700 Club is still around.
Yes, yeah, the 700 Club. Yeah.
Which is like, oh my god. Theora's got a great line after Max has been being a goofball or whatever, and she says, "Oh no, he's been in the Dobie Gillis file again."
Oh yes, that was good. That was a good one.
But yeah, it's got. First of all, it got the first appearance of Angie Berry, a character I wish we'd gotten more of, played by Rosalind Chow.
Yes, yeah.
And we got a kind of to give us kind of an impression she's like a reporter like Edison, but I guess in the next episode she's more of like the helicopter person or yes. Also or the camera
second,
operator.
Yeah, secondary sort of stand-in if Edison is not.
Yeah, and she's very charming with like her few lines she has, uh-huh. And I kind of wish maybe they had expanded a little bit more and given her more to do.
Yeah,
but
she's one of those characters you see and you immediately think if the show had gone on, she would have been a much more substantial character, I would think.
Yeah.
I'd like, too, that they mentioned Teddy Ruxpin at one point.
Yes.
That's fun. Dobie Gillis, Teddy Ruxpin, the 700 Club, come on. This has got it all. Yeah, did they mention Arthur Godfrey or anything like that? I'm trying what else could they have thrown in? But they do mention that the sort of fake artificial intelligence people that this church has created that basically just say, yes, wonderful, to everything. Yes. They're basically like Teddy Ruxpin. They have a pre-programmed thing that they, you know, they tell you a story or whatever. I never had a Teddy Ruxpin. I didn't grow up in a she house, all right? We didn't get Teddy Ruxpin. We got a teddy bear, and my dad stood behind it and did a voice. So what else do you have on this? I do like when the networks are discussing it at the beginning, and at one point they say something about this new age group, something like, well, they're the professionals.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I like that they like, and they're more popular than everyone except the Catholics or something like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing I really liked is just like a little side thing, but I mean, that Bryce explains like the real science behind, you know, like supposedly these images of like that are, you know, supposedly your dead husband or wife or whatever. And he's like, no, in order to have this be, you know, like really that person, it would take trillions of bits of data, mm-hmm. you know, to really have a personality. Otherwise it would just be, like Teddy Ruxpin mm-hmm. kind of thing. And it was kind of neat to have that actual reality thrown in there instead of just saying, oh yeah, they're creating these,
yes,
you know, things with enough memory, like a Blu-ray or something. And like, no, but yeah, you know, it's funny because I remember when I watched this way back in the 80s, and I remember really enjoying it, and I liked, there was something about the technology, even though it was kind of like a cross between advanced technology and very steampunky, you know, like 1930s kind of idea of this, you know, image. Because like when the old lady and she's talking yes. supposedly to her husband, you know, it really looked like that early kinescope.
I was going to yes, something you know, might even see in Metropolis somewhere, like in a corner.
Yeah, yeah. And it's got like a little dial
yes.
underneath mm-hmm. that you push button and you insert your credit to stick or whatever. And that's one of the things with Max Headroom that I love about the show that fascinates me is it's a different kind of viewing experience than just watching, you know, some other network show at the time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really is. I like the fact that it really does feel like they're trying. It's not like they came up with Max and then the rest of it is just sort of they really are trying to sort of construct this world and all these little component parts. Like in the last one, we got the Academy, and this one we get to see sort of the crazy televangelistic side, you know, the religion and stuff like that. Where will we go from here? Well, we'll go to a few more places because there aren't a lot of episodes, but it's nice to see all the world building is I think it's actually it's becoming sort of much better as it's going along, because I'm just thinking again of that episode that I don't like from the first season.
The Rakers.
Yeah, like that one. Like you watch that one and you think, wow, you guys ran out of ideas already. Wow.
Well, but they did have that feel. It felt like, what do we do now?
What a crazy futuristic sport. Can we go beyond Thunderdome? Let's do it.
It's like they're skateboarders, but they have weapons and they do stuff.
Yeah, and everyone's crazy about it. Why? I don't know.
And somehow it's a news story that just has to be broken.
That has to be broke immediately.
The thing I did like about the ending of this is that they didn't go so far as to arrest Vanna. She just kind of, you see her, she's, you know, defeated, and she walks off screen.
Yes.
And that's it, which kind of gives you the impression, like, maybe we might see her again.
Yeah.
We don't.
Yeah.
Heads up, we don't. But it really worked for me on every level. And, you know, also to point out that the evil president from 24, Gregory Itzen, President Logan, plays an equally weaselly character here. As Vanna's right-hand guy. And I think one of the things that's wonderful with this show is that we get so many different types of villain. Mm-hmm. You know, and as we'll see in the next episode, I think there's a bunch of them in that one, but
yes.
there's one in particular that's a personal favorite, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, because when I like that, I mean, I think I may have read a little blurb about what was going to happen in this episode, which we are already ruining it. We hope you watched it, everyone, before this.
Yeah.
But one of the fun things must have been, if you first watched it and you didn't know what was going on, why Edison is so reticent. That almost rhymed, but it didn't. It doesn't rhyme. Edison is so reticent to go and talk to the church, that church. And you're like, why is he being like that? And it's funny because he always dives in the middle of everything, but the moment he's like, he says to Murray, like, I don't think we should do this one. Murray's like, what's wrong with you? What? And Murray kind of almost goes after him for a moment. It's like, Murray, calm down. Calm down.
Murray's apoplectic.
He's there. He's there every single time for you. And now he's saying, maybe not on this one. And you're acting like he screws up. Like he's the office screw up and he did it again. And it's great when he goes in there and she immediately punches him out. And I like the way that happens, because when you see the Vanna character sort of almost deified on the screen talking about the money they need and how we're all going to be resurrected and blah, 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 and this, that, and the other. When Edison shows up and she steps out and she looks beautiful and she steps towards him and she just cold cocks him.
Yeah.
And it's very unexpected. Although if you read a little something about it beforehand, you kind of get the feeling that something like that might happen. But if you don't, you see it, and she approaches him, and then she punches him. You know, what the heck? And then you think, oh, they must know each other. And then you get the story from there. And you just it's interesting all the way this world is now, and when they go back to the past, they mention Dobie Gillis, they mention I was going to say Rupert Pupkin, but Teddy Ruxpin.
Rupert Pupkin.
I don't know what. And you know the way they talk about like Vanna and Edison were together like in college for 2 or 3 years or something like that. You know, you saw that. I was never together with anyone that long in college, but you saw that with people, you know, who would get together and they spend almost their whole college time together, just going on. And then you learn that they spent most of their time fighting and arguing with one another, and that, you know, happens too. And I like that it feels very, for Edison being I think in the next episode, Theora says something to him like, when something happens, she says, well, it's nice to know you're not perfect after all. And I thought, Theora, didn't you see him in the previous episode?
yeah. when they were talking about how he was a crappy boyfriend. so I like that. I like that they you know, Bryce, the background we see of him is probably his only background, being a smart kid and doing smart things with other smart kids, a bunch of smart asses. But then with Edison, you get to see, like, before he became this reporter, this possibly, it's tough to tell from the episode, but maybe this wonderful woman he spent time with, and they got really close, and then they argued a lot, and then it fell apart, and then he ran out on her and did just, he did whatever he did to her at the end involved her punching him in the face.
Well, I was wondering, I wonder if, like, the ending of that relationship is how he got to be so cynical.
Mm. Oh, maybe. Yeah, maybe there's...
Because you get the impression that when they were together that he was a lot more free spirit.
Yes.
You know, I'm not sure. But so let me ask you a question about Vanna. There, when you have the scenes with just the two of them talking, do you get the impression that she might actually believe that she can pull off the resurrection thing, or is she just gaslighting the hell out of him and she's really good at it?
That's a good question, because I almost bought it from her on occasion there when she was describing it. I think I don't think she believes that she can do it. But I think she believes that she can convince almost anyone that she can, and maybe that means she can do it. I don't know, but there is a, that doesn't answer your question. But
I was just wondering. I mean, is she arrogant enough to think she can do it, or is it really, you know, she's just really, really good at BSing her way through?
I thought it was. To me, it was somewhere in the middle. Like I. There's obviously a certain arrogance there and a certain BS, but I also kind of believe that she hoped maybe somewhere that something might happen if they prepared it the best way they could. Maybe it might go how they wanted, but I, for some reason, I found her generally very sincere.
Right.
I mean, when she was gabbing up and asking for money, that's even she herself was like, you gotta pitch, you know, you gotta make your cash. But when she was talking to Edison, I felt like a lot of times she was sincere, and maybe he just got more cynical when he was with her, and she seemed more sincere. But it's funny, like I don't know if it was I don't know if I'm just a sucker. But I don't think she fully believed that we're gonna do everything we say. But I think in some space she wanted to help these people achieve some sort of happiness or relief or something. And yes, that involves taking a lot of their money. But I think there was sort of a goodness and sincerity there. Even if it got clouded up in all these shenanigans, I don't. Yeah, it's tricky because I had, when I was watching it, my mind kind of kept switching back and forth between like, oh, she's full of it, or oh, she believes it, or oh, is she gonna, maybe she's on the right track. Nah, she's full of it, and it kept jumping all around. But to actually pin it down to one thought, if I had to pin it down to one thought, I would guess I would have to say that she's BSing people. But she's also, I think, not, she's BSing people, but she also is hoping that she's like not like hurting people. She wants people to be happy and enjoy this, even if she knows that it's kind of a pile.
Yeah, I got the impression that like she obviously wants to get the money.
Yeah.
You know, because she's clearly got, you know, this extravagant lifestyle and everything. But I don't think in her head that she thinks she's hurting people. I think she thinks she's giving them what they want. She's getting what she wants.
And it's just it's a little tricky to convince Edison of that, unless she, forgive me, adds a little booty to the mix. Because that, if you're teetering, oh yeah, that'll sometimes send you. Yeah, I believe you now. Not that Edison ever says that or anything, but. But yeah, no, that's an interesting question, and one I was hoping you wouldn't ask.
You're welcome.
So what else do you have on this? I'm going to scan my notes.
I don't think I have anything. Oh, well, I do like the fact that they say, well, it's bigger than Islam and, yes, you know, Catholicism, whatever, and IBM.
Yeah.
Like, what? Is that a religion in the future? But yeah, I really enjoyed the episode overall. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it is very. And isn't there a bit of an intimation? Although you don't know if she's being serious or not. With Thor, kind of gives Murray a look at one point. Kind of. They're talking, and it's kind of, she implies that you know, Edison's great, but she might be a little more interested in Murray.
Well, she does have a line in the next episode that kind of might cement that.
Oh, boy. That's something to look forward to. That'll be your cliffhanger to the next one, everyone. So if that's all you got and that's all I got, would you like to tell us where you are online, or would you like to talk a little – or would you like to ask me more questions that I can't answer?
Well, oh, so many questions. But
that's another podcast.
You can find me and my co-host, Agni Hogaboom, on Beauty, the Beast, and the Bees, which is a genre film podcast. And we should be back, I'm hoping, fairly soon, because we've been off the air with different disasters, natural and unnatural. So hopefully we'll be back pretty quickly here.
All right. Thank you, as always. And geez, I'm trying to think what we're doing. Oh.
Carol.
That's Linda.
Is brunette and tall. Sydney.
That's Linda.
Is streetwise and small. And together they solve crimes while he is super high.
Oh, yeah.
They call the cops a lot. They got here just in time. They're friends of mine.
These ladies are partners in crime.
That was the original lyric version of the Partisan Crime theme, sung by its lyricist, Mr. S. Peel. Actually, I'm not sure if that's S initial Peel for last name, or whether that's Spiel. Maybe like Prince or Cher, the name is Spiel. I can't quite tell from what I have here. But anyways, we're going to keep playing that from now on, because I like it. Murder in the Museum. The third episode as broadcast of Partners in Crime, directed by Rod Daniel, written by April Kelly. This aired October 6, 1984. And this one, Carol and Sydney go to a museum. Carol meets up with an old friend of hers who's now assistant curator. Soon after that, her friend, the assistant curator, is killed. Oh boy. And it's up to Sydney and Carol to find out who that killer could be. Is it Lee McCloskey? Maybe. Let's find out. Stan, Peel, let's do this.
Murder in the Museum, the third broadcast episode of Partners in Crime. And as with the previous two, I have here the great Mr. Stan Peel. Stan, how are you, sir?
I am great, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing okay. And I just want to say, I don't know if you ever heard any Stan stuff, but one of the things Stan loves to do during his podcast is he loves to eat while he's recording. And he'll get a good mouthful of food, and he'll lean into the mic. And he'll say, what am I eating? And now, right now, he just, someone just handed him a slice of pizza. And oh, damn it. I just ruined it. They know it's pizza. Okay, well, let's pretend I didn't say that. Let's throw a spoiler alert back on that. But Stan has some good-looking pizza. Where's that pizza? Is that homemade, Stan, or is that from somewhere nearby? Or?
It's a hybrid of homemade. It's like it's frozen pizza, uh-huh. But my wife and I, you know, my wife sautés everything, and then she like throws all this stuff on there, and then I'm actually a certified pizza maker.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, I worked for a long time at a pizzeria, so I've got the skills. I know how to distribute the mushrooms. I can do it.
So Stan will be eating throughout this this cup. And I guess, how about this? Yeah. Guess the toppings. There's probably mushrooms on there since he said them, but there may not be.
Away.
Remember, one of the rules of this podcast is we do lie sometimes. So Stan will be eating, and we're going to go from there. So I'm going to say, Stan, get a mouthful of pizza and tell me what you thought of Murder in the Museum.
Okay. Well, I thought it was really terrific. Like, it was It was a big improvement over the last couple of episodes that we've seen. Now I'm swallowing my pizza. With a lot of cheese in that bite. So we've seen, this is the third episode that we've seen. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they were really sort of finding their groove. They had better chemistry. Mm-hmm. There was better definition of characters between the two. You know, Lonnie is really like, you know, this sarcastic wisecracker, and Linda's kind of more sincere and thoughtful. And that definition may have been there in the earlier episodes, but I really feel like it was just a more comfortable fit. You know what I mean? And it got me to thinking, because I know a lot of times, you know, things are shot out of sequence. And so I was looking at the Wikipedia. I remembered that, you know, earlier when I had looked at the Wikipedia a while ago, I saw that there were production numbers next to the episodes. And
yes.
You're better at this than I am, but my assumption is that these production numbers will give you a clue as to when things were shot.
They should.
Or like,
yeah.
In what order.
Yeah, they
should. So this is, you know, 780-02, 780-03.
Okay.
So it's like 780 is the show, mm-hmm. and then 02 and 03 and 04,
yes.
those are the... So, according to that, the two episodes that we saw already were definitely shot early on,
uh-huh.
but this, Murder in the Museum, is the third or fourth to last episode.
Oh, wow, okay.
In production order.
All right.
It's like, and what's weird about the production numbers is they skip, and I don't know if that means anything.
Mm.
But there's like 2, 3, 4, and then 6, 7, 8, and then 12, 13, 14.
Oh, yeah, are all the numbers there? They're just out of order? Are there numbers missing? Or
There are numbers missing. Like, those are, if I put them all in order...
Uh-huh.
Then it's 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 12, 13, 14, 15, 17, 20. Like, the last episode is 20 all of a sudden.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if they had scripts that they numbered, and maybe...
It could have been... that, you know what's funny? It says, I don't know that I've... I mean, my first thought is they were episodes that didn't air, but I doubt there were episodes that didn't air, because they're 13, and usually they do 13.
Right, right.
Gosh, I wonder. I mean, I would guess maybe they assign production numbers to scripts and something fell through. That's the only thing I could think of. That's interesting. I've never really seen that before. Like, numbers usually it'll be like the pilot, a lot of times, sometimes won't have a number, or sometimes
right.
it'll just be one, you know, and then the rest are 2 through 13, just in whatever order they're
in. Yeah.
Huh.
So it's weird, but it does sort of indicate to me that this episode was definitely later in the mm-hmm. in the production schedule, mm-hmm. and I think you can kind of tell, like, at least with Linda and Lonnie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my thoughts on it are, I really like the two of them in this, and mm-hmm. and now that you, it's funny, because the problem I had with it was I thought the mystery was, pardon me, kind of crap.
Yeah.
And the fact that they actually give away the ending in the teaser before the episode begins, like, they show you who committed the murder. The person with the gun, holding the gun on Lonnie, is probably going to be the killer. And I saw that and I thought, are you kidding? And that worried me, because my first thought was, a teaser's, especially something that's like meant to be a mystery, you don't put the killer in the closing thing, unless you're trying to do something clever. And I don't think they were. And so I got worried. I thought, is the episode going to be so uninteresting that they were like, well, we got to put in shots from the ending because we don't have anything else. But then I thought, Lonnie spends half the episode in a really short skirt. Surely that could have been just the 30 seconds of the teaser.
Yes. They could have substituted that.
It's an interesting episode because they're very good, and you could get the feeling, like, when they're in the museum in the beginning, when they're breaking into the museum, you get the real feeling of the chemistry between
yeah.
them, and that they really, now they've got it down, they're working together. But at the same time, like I said, the mystery is, like, the mystery, it's so obvious what who the killer is, that you almost think it's an error. You almost,
yeah.
like, because there's basically a part where I think Lee McCloskey's character, Casey, like, is walking down a hall, and then he enters an office, closes the door behind him. Then Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. there, whose character's name I forget, the head of the museum, he steps out of another room and opens the door of that office, and there's the dead woman, and there's Lee Casey right there. It's, oh, my God, you killed, and I didn't kill her. Oh, my God. It's, and you think, well, surely the... that guy killed her, right? That's how he knew to walk in right at that moment and found her with the body, and he's jumped to conclusions. Yeah. And it's one of those tricky things where you see that and you think, are they playing with us? You know, are they kind of because? Yeah. And I say that because a couple scenes later, there's a bit where they go, our gals go to meet the Casey character, like somewhere under a bridge or something like that.
And
they go to meet him in all secrecy. But the moment they walk under that space where he's hiding, a cop car pulls up. And it's basically like, hey, isn't that the killer's car? Yep. And they get out. And you're like, wait a minute. And then they stroll in, catch him, and then instantly arrest our leading ladies, too, with no evidence that they've done anything. And so I thought, wait a minute. Yeah. There are so many little moments in here that are like, what? Why did that happen? Yeah. That I thought maybe the thing where Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. finds Casey with the body was maybe something to throw us off. Maybe that was something like, I'm confused. But in the end, it wasn't. I feel like almost like maybe the script was a little too long and they trimmed things a little. Because when the cop pulls up and like you finds the car right away, you're like, that's in the entire city of San Francisco? This cop is at the exact moment? That's too coincidental.
It was weird. You know, I was just getting ready to compliment the script, but I mean, it is true that the story is oversimplified. I guess I was kind of relieved after the last episode
I was going to say that. I was going to mention that.
but I did think like the dialogue was really snappy, and in fact, I looked up April Kelly.
She's quite good.
She wrote a whole bunch of Mork and Mindy. She was the first season editor and wrote Boy Meets World and she wrote Joni's Dilemma on Happy Days.
She did
at press time here. You had just talked about Rockin' All Week with You.
Is Joni going to go to Inspiration Point with the boy kind of thing? It's a nicely done episode, actually. It's quite a nicely done episode. Yeah, she also co-wrote the second I Dream of Jeannie reunion movie.
Oh my gosh.
the second time that they couldn't get Larry Hagman back. Oh, you know, the first time I understand, but the second time, come on. And she actually does a good job with it because it's a pretty entertaining movie, even though you sit there the whole time wishing Larry Hagman was there. Yeah, now, they do get Ken Kershaval, who played Larry Hagman's nemesis in Dallas, to be in it. He's in it, Cliff Barnes, but it's not quite the same. But yeah, she's a good writer. And when I saw like the mystery, like you said, it almost seems like I just had this thought, just the way they sort of ruined it in the opening, and there were some moments that seemed very simplified, mixed in. It's almost like watching this isn't quite right, but like watching a Marx Brothers movie where like every time the Marx Brothers are on, it's fantastic. But then when they actually have to do the plot, it feels like no one really kind of is like, okay. But yeah, it's like when Linda and Lonnie are doing their thing, it's so much fun to watch them. But when we actually go into the mystery, like when they're in the jail cell with that prostitute, I love those scenes.
Just that was great. My father was a ballerina. Look how I turned out. That's what the hooker says.
How can we keep letting them go? And you We've been in here 6 hours. Why did it take you so long? Well, if you don't do anything, I can get you out easily. Breaking and entering took some time.
That's a problem.
So it's so weird because like whenever they deal with the mystery, it's almost like I almost thought it almost felt to me like I said, they give the ending away in the teaser. It almost felt to me like it was like a training script for like young people writing mysteries. So like we don't want you to worry about who did it, because we want you to look at the structure. So we're going to show you who did it in the beginning, and then we want you to watch it and see how the mystery goes. Almost like we're teaching like high schoolers or grade schoolers. Here's how you do a mystery, and they kept it very simple and they kept it very basic. But then they handed it to, you know, the folks at Partners in Crime, and they let added all the stuff for the two gals to do.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that any of that's true. I could be lying about all of that, but I agree with Stan that this is, I think, better than the ones we watched previously. But in simplifying the mystery, they may have simplified it a little. There's no real mystery at the end. You get to the end, and no. It's like there's no real mystery. Everything you think is going to happen kind of happens, and there's no.
Yeah, and then. I will say, though, I mean, you know, whoever put together the montage at the beginning was probably not, you know, not the director, not somebody really, you know, it was like a producer who was like, we need to really sell this thing.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. let's show all the really interesting shots.
Yeah, yeah. And it even gets to the point where, like, in the end, when the killer has Lonnie and he thinks someone's in the museum and he's just like shooting the hell out of all the exhibits. I don't think he'd do that. That would be like Batman discovering like the Joker was hidden in the Batcave and then just burning it down or something like that. You know, just torching the Batcave to get the Joker. He wouldn't do that. He'd try to catch him first, and that would be the absolute last thing he'd do. To bring up another detective there, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I'm saying. Who sometimes has very simple cases.
Yeah. I did like, as goofy as it is that he shot up his own museum, I did like the way that scene was shot.
It like, is nicely done, though, yeah.
Like that and, I'm thinking of, I'm getting confused about another episode. But there was something nice about that that scene.
It does It does have decent suspense in it. You don't think he's going to kill Lonnie or Sydney, but it does. It is decently shot.
Right, right. I was just looking at my notes and was going to go off totally on a tangent. So.
Please. What else do you have? I'm gonna scan my notes. You go.
Well, speaking of, you know, when Lonnie and Linda aren't there, there are problems. one of the things that caught me right away was. I don't think the casting, whoever was casting this, maybe didn't read the script, but Linda, who was Linda's friend, Carol's friend,
yes,
who was the person who gets killed, spoiler alert, in the beginning. she's talking to Lee McCloskey, and he's talking to her like, you know, like she's a cougar or something, like, I'm a young guy with an older woman, and that, you know, the whole. Young guy, older woman gag sort of, it's a little weird, but it does pay off at the end of the episode.
Yes,
but when he's talking to her, I'm like, he definitely doesn't look younger than her. And I looked it up. He was born in 55. She was born, I think, in 61 at the earliest. Maybe 65 or 61. Like, her credits started in 83. Mm-hmm. So she was either 18 or she got out of college or something, but she couldn't be younger than, you know, being born in 60 or 61. So that makes her 5 or 6 years younger than him.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, and this is, you know, it's women seem to be cast in roles that are way older than the actress actually is. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. Think that's changing,
it's kind of weird too, like with Linda Carter. Her character is always like, oh, there she is, she was so most likely to succeed, she worked so hard, oh my god, she's always working. That's her, she's always working. But then all we really find out about her is that she's sleeping with the curator of the museum. And I thought, really, is that most likely to succeed? I mean, I guess. I don't know.
And she was sleeping with Lee McCloskey on their dig in Peru or wherever it was.
And then she came back, and now she's with Mr. Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. It's a weird episode where whenever, like I said, whenever the two leads are doing their thing, It's a lot of fun, and it does, now that you said that it's a later episode, you can feel the chemistry. It has picked up. There's a fun to it there. But at the same time, the script seems to have, like someone seems to have taken the script and been like, no, dumb this down. No, that's too much. Too complicated. Yeah. Make it simpler. Yeah, nope. Think 12-year-old. Nope, not smart 12-year-old. Think.
Not a smart 12-year-old. Come on.
But it's kind of a weird episode. But then I thought, well, is this the show? If maybe this is the way they wanted the show to go, where it was like a simpler mystery with more fun between the two leads, more back and forth, which definitely would be something. I mean, that's like when I think of Charlie's Angels, I sort of think of that. You know, like a lot, when I haven't seen a lot of Charlie's Angels, but the ones I saw, they weren't, you know, the airtight, you know, magical mysteries like written by Agatha Christie or anything like that. They were kind of goofy, fun, where the gals are fun, and it's they beat some guys up and things like that. And so if this is the way the show is going to be, then let's go, let's roll with it. Let's see where it goes.
Yeah, like one of my favorite scenes is them, you know, the first time they break into the museum, and you know, Lonnie and Linda have, you know, some really funny interaction when they're getting up to the entrance, and then Lonnie sort of takes over with this security guard, and she, you know, takes him out to her car, which she says is having trouble, and she does this whole sort of seduction and tells him that she's, you know, one of the exotic dancers at some, you know, the Magnolia Room or something.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that sounds right.
And he's, and you know, there's sort of the idea that she's gonna pay him back for her help, and so she says, you know, go to the Magnolia Room and ask for, or you know, ask for me, and she drives away, and this goofball looks at her driving away and says, boy, she's gonna have the time of her life. And it has nothing to do with the story, but funny.
That was an interesting, because I imagine probably in the universe he lives in, he gets women like that all the time doing stuff like that. We had four women break in here today. Really? Really? Because I got four hot names down for the Magnolia Room. Big Bob is headed to the Magnolia Room Saturday night. Yeah, that was it. And I like how Lonnie immediately puts on like the Southern accent. Like she's been a Southern belle who's deserted somewhere, something like that. You know, not that she's just in the middle of San Francisco and she's pretending. She really gets into it. You know, they get into it when they're doing that.
Yeah, I forgot how much I enjoy her sense of humor.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I will say the one thing as I watch the episodes is I do kind of like Lonnie a little bit more than Linda in some of the episodes. I don't know why that is. I feel like just because she's a little more fun, I feel like they haven't quite like got to a point where Linda is more than slightly stick in the mud sort of.
Yeah, I do. As much as I love Linda Carter, she just doesn't have the comic timing that Lonnie
does.
She
doesn't. Yeah, she's trying, but she doesn't, unfortunately.
And she has a lovely sincerity, which comes out in places, but like when she's talking about her friend who got murdered, and you know, so she doesn't want to meet with this guy because he probably killed her. It does come off more like she's a stick in the mud and she's not paying attention. As opposed to being, you know, sincerely grieving for her friend, I think is the idea. But but we didn't really get, the problem is we also didn't get that relationship established. Like as soon as her friend showed up in the museum at the beginning, she was already ignoring Linda the moment she came up to her. She was ignoring her friend, and she's like, why are you friends with this person?
Museum
person. She's very rude and she doesn't like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her friend was like one conversation ahead, sort of. And
right.
Yeah. It's and all we're getting for how great the friend is, like I said earlier, is Linda tells us that she's fantastic.
Right.
And you're like, okay, well we you know, we trust because it's you, but we'll let it go this time. But maybe next time, let's see a little proof.
Yeah.
Just a little show don't tell.
Yeah.
What else do you have on this one? I will say when I got to the end of it, I thought that was entertaining, and then I thought about the mystery and such, and I thought, there's really nothing, almost nothing happens. It's really very like. And I don't know if I'm just being a jerk, but that tablet that they're fussing over throughout the episode, did that?
Yeah.
I mean, when you first see that on the shelf at the beginning, I thought, why are they fussing over this styrofoam tablet?
Exactly.
It never looked. If that's one of those tablets that guy that Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. keeps calling to make fake stuff is doing, he needs better. He needs better fakers.
Because every single person, including Lonnie Anderson, threw it around like it was made of styrofoam.
It's this important tablet that's not on the audit list and everything. And I guess we can be spared that the mystery didn't end with exciting audit action. You know, it's just like five auditors sitting at like here you go, here's the tape, come on. So I bet that was in the original script. We're gonna cut the audit climax because it's not as exciting as you think it is.
It's not. We're gonna go with the young guy going out with the older lady. That'll be
our gag that wraps it up. Whether that makes any sense or not, it mostly does, kind of does, but there's something about that joke at the end where he goes out with what's her name, the mother-in-law, instead of Lonnie Anderson. We're like, okay, I get the joke, but really?
I appreciate the joke. I don't believe it, but I appreciate it.
I appreciate the joke, but again, that lends credence to my write this for 12-year-old writers in training.
Yeah.
So it's like, here's a joke. It doesn't fully make sense, but it's a very obvious joke, and you can see what we're doing. Make it more subtle. Make it funnier.
Right.
I'm not saying that, you know, the network said, we're going to use this episode of Partners in Crime to train the young people of America to write mysteries. I'm not saying that's what happened, but wouldn't it have been great if that's what happened?
Yes.
Wouldn't it be great if we found some paper somewhere where it was like, we're using this episode. We've got 500 kids who are going to be watching and taking notes. And then they'll be submitting their own scripts for Partners in Crime. And that's what all the breaks are in the production thing, because they were scripts that the kids sent in. This will be number 15. That doesn't work. Damn it. Well, we can't tell the kids that. We'll break their hearts. We'll leave the number open. We won't shut the number if they call that's still in production. Yeah. And then the show gets canceled. It doesn't get made. Nothing we can do. I like it. It all makes sense now.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. It all makes sense. What else do you have on this one? I think I'm kind of at the end. I mean, it's always fun to see Lee McCloskey, who I know best as being the star of Argento's Inferno. Mm-hmm. And he also plays he marries Lucy, Charlene Tilton's character, on Dallas in an early season of Dallas.
Yeah, okay.
I want to say he's... could be thinking of someone else she marries. I want to say he's like a doctor or something like that, and he ends up sort of abandoning her or something like that because he's big into his burn unit,
right?
And she's not so much. I could be making that up, however. But he is in Dallas, maybe third, fourth, fifth season, something like that. And he marries Lucy, and he's there for a couple seasons. But he's always fun to watch. He's a good looking guy. It's fun to watch him flirt with Lonnie, and Lonnie is very much. I love Lonnie's character because she's so. You know, she knows exactly what's going on. Whenever a guy comes up to her and speaks to her, you know, it's like it just takes about 4 seconds for her to know, like, what are you doing? What game are you playing? You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. I like that. She's very, you know, whereas Linda Carr, she doesn't have that happen as often. She does have it. She has that happen with older guys more her age.
It happened with David Soul in the last one. And he was like, you know, I don't know if we talked about this, but he was in a different show. He was like playing this heavy drama.
Yes, he was. It'll be kind of like you're in a dramatic mystery version of Shampoo. Think of it that way.
Right.
You got it. I could do
by
that.
By the way, I hope it's not too late to mention this. I didn't mention it last time, but but Linda Carter, one of her very first acting roles before she got Wonder Woman was a small part on Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
oh,
wow. So I don't know if she was returning the favor or what. But,
maybe.
But I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. So Murder in the Museum, anything else on this one? I'm just going to do a quick scan of my notes.
Okay, I've got a couple of things.
Please throw them out.
Just a few notes here. First of all, in the first scene at the museum, there's a giant fish, And I don't know if you've ever seen Monster on the Campus, this old black and white.
Yeah, the Jack Arnold. Yeah.
For some reason, my brain went there, and I'm like, that's the Monster on the Campus fish.
Yes.
And also, right in the beginning, when the scene you mentioned where Casey goes into the office and discovers the dead body, right before he gets there, there's a woman who passes him, just an extra, walking away from the camera. She has the largest shoulder pads I've ever seen. And I think, like for me, and probably you who grew up in the 80s, shoulder pads, like they don't even register with me sometimes because I've seen them my whole life. But, people, I guess, born at a later time maybe aren't aware of the whole shoulder pad thing.
Yeah.
And if they had seen that woman, they would wonder why the hell her shoulders were gigantic.
She just left a meeting with Ming the Merciless on the third floor. She's going to meet Brian Blessed. I know the woman you're talking about. She almost kind of runs into him, sort of, as they get very close to one another. When he comes around the corner,
I always appreciate Shane, as in his little role, but he serves breakfast at some point in an absolutely filthy apron, and I'm like, I get that he's kind of a goofball, like a slovenly guy, but like. Like serving food with that kind of filth on you, I just seems really...
Change the apron or flip the apron. How about that? Flip the apron around. We don't need to know.
And just one more note that I've got here. Lonnie says, I feel like I'm in an Ida Lupino movie when she's sitting there in the cell. And I kind of didn't know who Ida Lupino was, I looked it up and.
Yeah.
So this is what I found. I don't know if I'm just an idiot and don't know who she is, but apparently she's regarded as one of the most prominent female filmmakers working in the 1950s during the Hollywood studio system. She had an independent production company. She wrote and produced social message films, which I guess was what Lonnie Anderson was talking about.
Yes, exactly. She was a Ida Lupino's fed. She was also an actress. She's in the great 16mm Shrine episode of Twilight Zone, the early one, with the actress who spends all her time sitting in a screening room watching her old movies.
Oh, I love that.
And then eventually, I won't ruin the twist, but something happens. But she directed a Twilight Zone, I believe. Don't quote me on that, but I believe she also directed. Yeah, she was one of the first big female directors in Hollywood. Yeah, she's classic sort of noir-y, social message-y kind of films. Very, very, very interesting woman. And Lonnie is correct. The moment she said that, I laughed. So that was a great reference.
And just one more thing. I noticed the end credits. So the first two episodes, the end credits were just, there were just shots, like still shots of the scenes. And this is the first time during the ending credits that they showed they showed like moving images. They showed little scenes of what was happening during the episode, which actually ended in still shots. It was a little bit of both.
That's, sort of the other. Hey, we're going over that. Executive producer, da-da-da-da, music by. I love it. I wonder if we were to watch them in what we would believe to be the production order, if you'd see it go from the still shots to we got a little bit more money, put some movement in those closing credits, or people are getting bored during the credits, they want to see Lonnie and Linda move.
I think that's exactly what happened. I'm sort of saving it for the next episode, but the next episode is the pilot, and there's nothing at the end. Like there's one shot of a building, and they just stay on it the whole time. I think that the production order had something to do with how they improved the ending credits.
And I will say this, folks, I don't always watch. I try not. I usually don't watch the teasers at the beginning if it's something I haven't seen, because I don't like to have it ruined. But this is the second time I watched it. I happened to catch the teaser, and I do remember seeing the ending and thinking, "Huh, there you go." I don't really have any other stuff. I do have Ida Lupino movie down here, and I did write down, this seems like my first mystery which is the what I'm calling the thing they were doing for the 12-year-olds.
I will say,
yeah.
If I may, just because I'm a staunch defender of Linda, she has a sort of sweetness about her in terms of comedy. Like, it's maybe not big league comedy timing like Lonnie Anderson has, but like when she talks about never being able to find her keys.
That's a nice little bit, yeah.
It's very sweet, and I feel sorry for her that she can't find her keys.
And I feel she's almost, I guess, a more straight man, kind of, or straight woman to Lonnie's kind of thrown out the wisecracks.
Yeah, which is like, and that's a great structure to have.
You got it. That works beautifully. You know, Abbott and Costello did it for years, and people are still laughing.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, the way they resolve the key thing, where she's like... I forget exactly how it resolves, but then the mother-in-law comes in and she's got the capper line with, I got your keys right here, which is nicely done. And so Linda is able to kind of carry the scene, and then the big joke comes in, the mother-in-law strolls in, does the gag, and boink, there you go. Right. And it's nicely done, I thought.
Yeah.
But I think, and not to put Linda down, because this isn't full-on comedy. This is comedy with... the mystery and the excitement stuff too, and she does great in that. Obviously, when she's on the screen, it's Linda Carter. She's charismatic, she's commanding, but the thing is, she's also up against Lonnie Anderson, who is just as charismatic and commanding and has a little more grasp of the comedy. Occasionally there are moments when Lonnie kind of overtakes it when they're doing the shtick,
right?
I think And it was sort of like when Moonlighting started, like Bruce Willis was kind of like more high energy than Cybill Shepherd. But then after a bit, Cybill Shepherd is right there alongside him. You know, it takes a few episodes for her to, because that's part of her character too in the show. But that's kind of the way that goes. But so I guess I'll stop here.
Yeah.
If you don't have anything else, Stan, where can we find you online? What are you doing? How is your pizza?
The pizza is awesome. I want to really like. Dig into it. I have forgotten to mention, I have two places you can find me online.
Oh, wonderful.
Of course, my podcast is WonderWomanWednesdays.com. All the stuff is there right at that location. You can find the social media connections there. But also, I do have a weekly live Facebook, goofballery that I do.
That's a great word.
With my buddy Jack, we are the Real Guys, and you can find us on facebook.com/something that looks like the Real Guys. I meant to look it up, but I don't know what it is. But, you know, like try to, it's, you know, that the link is actually on WonderWomanWednesdays.com.
Okay.
Along with the link to this podcast, by the way.
So it's like a
listing of my favorite podcasts.
Thank you.
But yeah, so you can find us there or WonderWomanWednesdays.com. I'm doing those two things and trying to, you know, pay my bills too. So
yay. So that's the end of this one, folks. And the next episode will be the pilot. So the 2-hour pilot. But now we are going on to the final episode of Monster Squad.
Here it is, you guys. Those two half-breed criminals, half-wit and half-Nelson, they're half-brothers, you know. They broke out of a halfway house at 6:30 and got away in a half-track.
Is that the whole story?
That isn't the half of it. They were helped on the outside by someone who cut a hole in the wall with a laser beam. And that is where the mystery begins.
The whole story, get it?
The person with the laser beam was described by one very reliable witness as a man... and by another very reliable witness as a woman.
That's impossible. Somebody's got to be fibbing.
Maybe not. Maybe the person is both a man and a woman. What do you think, Bruce?
I think your brain must be full of peanut shells.
Peanut track, that's it. Perhaps the jailbreak is the work of Albert Alberta, the half-man, half-woman, remember?
I certainly do. I loved her, hated him.
I'm going to run that into the computer and see if it was him. Her. Whatever. Wait a minute. That'll have to wait. Special bulletin coming out.
Two hippopotamuses have just been stolen from the Bronx Zoo.
And two bull mooses stolen from the Alaskan zoo.
And two mongooses stolen from the Mongolian zoo.
Do you suppose there could be a connection?
I don't think so. Mongooses wouldn't have anything to do with hippopotamuses.
No, Frank. I mean a connection between the pairs of animals being stolen and Albert Alberta. I'm going to call him and her. Just so happens I have their private number. C-Squad, many archfiends are unlisted.
And so that's what's happening in this, the 13th and final episode, Monster Squad, December 4th, 1976, written by Courtney Andrews and Laurie Samara. Directed by James Sheldon. This is Albert Alberta. You just heard about Albert Alberta there. And now let me cut to the, it looks like a cruise liner kind of thing that Albert Alberta and their two henchmen, Halfwit and Half Nelson, are hanging out at, basically assembling their scheme. Let me play the scene, and then I'll be on the other side.
Coming along with the animals.
Pretty good, boss. They're all down below asleep. No trouble at all.
Except for the zebras. I thought they were horses, and I had a terrible time trying to pull off their pajamas.
I think we got a pair of almost every animal there is.
Good. But we can't have almost every animal. We must have absolutely a pair of every animal. Because when we flood the world with water, we will be the new Ark. You do understand that, don't you?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
And now with the rest of the animals. Have you picked the little things such as insects and whatnot?
Oh, yeah, sure. I picked up the two fleas this morning.
Bring the laser gun over. We're going to give the world a little sample. Huh?
Yeah, in a nutshell, yeah, Alberta's created an ark there in the New York City, the harbor, and had two of every animal, and gonna flood the world with the laser guns, melting the glaciers up on the North Pole, and we learn in a scene or two that the only thing they're missing a male vampire bat and a male werewolf. Well, surprisingly enough, Bruce and Drac show up, and Drac is in a cage as the vampire bat, and Bruce is there, and they welcome them on board, the last of the beings, creatures, animals, things that they need for the trip, and they put Bruce and Drac into a stateroom. And one side of the stateroom is the door in and out of the stateroom. The other side is one that has a sign out that says, like, to the female werewolf. And let me play this little scene here. This is Drac trying to sort of suss through what's happening while Bruce is getting lovelorn with his ear to the door of the room that apparently has the female werewolf in it.
What's through there?
The female werewolf. She's in the next stateroom.
What's the matter?
I can hear the sweet thing. She's gnawing a bone. It's like music. Be still, my foolish furry heart.
You forget that we have got work to do. Did you hear that? We're going to be leaving soon. Come on!
No, I'm staying. Now that I've finally found the lovely, hairy-faced, crooked teeth girl of my dreams. Leave me be!
No, I can't. We are a team. Frankenstein will be here soon.
So what? Let him find his own girl.
Bruce.
Oh, I'm in love. A gorgeous fur. What a cute upturned wet muzzle.
Hey, it may only be puppy love.
I'm all right now.
Come,
I will call Walter.
Right, Drac. I got it. Over and out. Frank, they need your help. Take the monster van and get over to the ship right away.
And away we go!
And yeah, Albert Alberto's plan really isn't to destroy everything. Really, they just want a lot of money from all the world's leaders. And soon after the scene you just heard, they have a machine called the Great Divider that they're going to put Drac and Bruce into, that's going to make them into half werewolf, half vampire. And they show us a photo of it. It looks fun. And the Great Divider, I think we've seen that Great Divider machine at least once before. Did someone try to turn them into sausages earlier in the run or something? You've seen it before. It's basically two conveyor belts going into sort of a central, like, box control unit thing that is only, like, big enough for about probably two-thirds of one of them. So presumably the moment they get in, they start getting sliced up and reconfigured or something like that. And I will say that you can tell that I think half Nelson straps down Drac and half Witt straps down Bruce. But Bruce is sort of being so sentimental at calling Walt and telling him he dug up the Rose Garden outside the museum and everything, that Halfwit forgets to strap Bruce in. So as soon as Frank busts through the door, Bruce just jumps out of where he is, frees Drac, and they have a big free-for-all. That's getting ahead of it a bit. But I'll just say, in the end of it, everything's okay. Albert Alberta is arrested, so is Halfwit, half Nelson. The laser is reversed, so all the glaciers freeze, and Albert goes to one prison and Alberta goes to another. I guess they were just arguing too much. So it's the final episode, everyone, and we get Walt never leaves the museum. He stays by the computer. Frank doesn't leave the museum until the end, but it's great because I think all the times we've ever seen the Monster Squad van, I think the implication to me has always been because it's the three of them together, and I always sort of thought for some reason Bruce Wolfman drove the van, but in this one very specifically, Frank does drive the van. So that's pretty cool. So I just like the thought of being at a red light, and you know they always leave in the middle of the night. So being at a red light in the middle of the night, wherever it is the Monster Squad are, and then all of a sudden just sort of turning your head and seeing this big van with Monster Squad and monster drawings on the side, and the Frankenstein monster driving the car. Man, that would have been awesome. That is a great 70s Chevy van. I don't know if it's a Chevy van. You can't really see it all that well. It's painted black. You only see it in the same exact three or four same shots over and over again. This episode also has a lot of shots of glaciers, like chunks of glaciers dropping off of bigger chunks into water, and stock footage of like docks with like the water going crazy. And there's one really long shot after they think they saved the day, but Alberta gets somehow gets back onto the laser and puts it on like full power to melt everything, all the glaciers. There's a really long shot of like an intersection, flooded intersection, where like a truck goes by, and then it goes through the intersection. There's a pause, and then another truck comes by the other direction. You know, sort of, one truck is going say north, and the other truck is going east, and it's a very long shot. I thought, is this padding? I don't know. It could be padding, I guess. There's some fun about the fact that whenever they're like on the ship and they seem to look out of portholes, they always like they see docks, they see streets. At one point, Frank seems to see the glaciers forming together again. So I like the concept. I mean, that's part of the fun, right, of it. It's just like whatever they look through we don't see a ship at the dock. We see a photo of a ship at the dock. And I like the fact that, there's no sign of glaciers around or intersections or anything. They're at the end of a dock in a harbor. And yet, whenever they look out, they always seem to see what they need to see. And I like that. And that goes with the comedy with, like, Drac having to stop himself from going into the ship's sick bay hospital thing because that is a blood bank. He's, he never drinks while he works. Little weird moments like half Nelson crying when he hears Drac being sad about wanting to be divided into half werewolf, half vampire, and he starts crying like a little girl. Alongside probably my favorite joke, which is In the middle of the room, Alberta sort of stateroom, there's something covered with a cloth, and it says, when you look at it, it says covered laser gun. And when you pull the cloth off, it says, on the laser gun, it says uncovered laser gun. I like that. I think that's fun. And I like, too, that Mezzo, the name of the ship, when you see the life preservers, the name Mezzo, half-half, is only on half of the life preserver. A lot of half jokes, a lot of pairs, middle jokes, things like that throughout the episode. A lot of them. And it's again like most of the episodes of the show, it's not the fastest moving thing in the world. It doesn't fly long. It goes at sort of a decent pace. And then Half-Wit and Half-Nelson, especially Half-Wit, are pretty dumb. But I think the episode is a lot of fun. It's a lovely one to go on because it is kind of, I mean, you get Alberta, who comes from the tradition of like a carnival sideshows and things of the half man, half woman, like down the middle sort of thing. And you know what I mean. Freaks. There's one of the movie Freaks, Todd Browning's Freaks. Vito Scotti plays Alberta, does a really nice job. He really shows up the Italian sort of, hey, what's going on? You know, kind of, hey, we're going to get these werewolves and things. But then when he turns and he's Alberta, he puts on the softer voice. And he's, it's really nice. The costume is a lot of fun to look at. It's just a really overall, it's a cool bit of a costume design for the villain there. And it's funny. I looked it up just to see in the half man, half woman in Freaks was, I think the name was like Josephine, I believe. Don't quote me on that. But the thing that made it interesting is there was, yes, Josephine Joseph, but there was an actual Alberta Karras, the European Enigma, and who was like a sideshow show performer, half man, half woman. Now the theory is apparently that. It says here, I'm quoting from Mark Hartzman's American Sideshow, which says, according to Mark Hartzman, Alberta was Harry Caro, female impersonator. He exercised one side of his body only and shaved the other, adding a false breast filled with bird seed. One side was hairy and muscular, the other was smooth and soft. And apparently he had a younger brother who I guess was female from the waist up and male from the waist down. And this, of course, obviously, you know, I'm not going to get into, this is a Monster Squad Saturday Morning TV Kids discussion. This is not a time for a gender discussion. But this was a, having a character like this on the show is fun because it's a dual character. It's the male side is always arguing with the female side and wants one thing over the other. And, like, there's a moment where Drac is going to destroy the laser, but Albert grabs a puppy and is going to throw the puppy out a porthole. And Alberta is absolutely shocked that Albert would do this, but does, you know, sort of verify that Albert would do this, so be careful. And it's, I like this kind of it's an interesting villain because you get the halves and halves and the male female, the whole arc thing. I think they work it through really nice. It's a lot of fun to watch. And one of the things that's interesting is, you get the main Wax Museum set, and you get some nice long shots of the set, like when the final sort of segment begins, you know, where Frank makes his wacky joke. And Frank does get to do "And Away We Go." He does get to do a Jackie Gleason impersonation, which I like. I like the fact that maybe they're this was in 76. I think, did Jackie Gleason have a show anymore in 76? I don't remember. Possibly, actually, his show may have ended earlier than that. I don't know. He did have something in this. Was it late 60s? Well, everyone still knew who Jackie Gleason was, right? We'd all seen Skidoo. But yeah, there are some nice sort of longer shots on the Wax Museum, and there's an odd moment at the beginning. You can't hear it in the opening clip I played, where Walt runs down and starts talking to the guys, but they're not brought to life yet, and then he has to open up the crime computer, which almost feels like a sort of early episode thing kind of to do, or maybe just the fact that he's so flustered by what's going on that he does that. One of the things I've noticed that's interesting, or maybe it's not, is if you watch the episode, almost quite a few of the scenes in sort of the stateroom, the room with the laser gun that turns out to also have the Great Divider. I love the way how the stateroom seems to be one space, and then all of a sudden the Great Divider is in the stateroom. So the stateroom is actually this huge room. But notice if you watch the DVD up at the top of the screen, kind of about not quite to slightly to the left of center, there's a little hair or something at the top of the screen, but only for certain shots, and almost all, I think, in the stateroom. And I think all sorts of shots that involve Albert Alberta. So I'm wondering if, because you notice that when, and even, the, yeah, like, it's interesting. I'm noticing this, like when Drac and Bruce go into the laser gun and they're by themselves, there's no little line or hair or whatever is at the top of the screen. But then when Albert Alberta comes in, you see it. So I'm wondering if like they had Vito Scotti like dressed like that on this set like one day, and it's interesting when they do the long shots of the Great Divider with everyone standing around, there's this little hair at the top of the screen. But then when they do the intercut shots, and then when they do the two shots of Bruce and Drac, there's no hair at the bottom. So that must mean that, I would bet Vito Scotti was there on that set for that day. Maybe just one day, probably more than one day, but say on that set for one day. And the reel of film that they used had some sort of issue. And there's that little hair at the top. Watch that little hair kind of go in and out, because it's, like I said, it's on all the spots with like Alberta, yeah, and it's gone. It cuts to Bruce and Drac, just the two of them, and it's not there. Putting the puppy out the window, it's all the insert shots and things, it's not there. Wow, that's interesting. Well, maybe it's not that interesting. Is it not as interesting to say the little piece of black tape on Tony Malinowski's Night of Horror, which is on the VHS, but is not, I should check the commentary, is not on the Blu-ray? You know the little piece of black tape I'm talking about. You get to miss that. Anyway. So overall, I think this is an excellent episode. I think about how this is Saturday morning, December 1976, and it's about wax figures of the Wolfman, Dracula, and the Frankenstein monster trying to stop a half-man, half-woman named Albert Alberta from firing laser guns into the North Pole ice to flood the world, because he has built an ark, they've built an ark that has two of every animal on it, and they're going to sail away. That's a little crazy, right? I mean, that's just pure, full-on, creative, fun nonsense. I mean, do wish the jokes were better? Oh, sure, but there are some fun bits here and there. Do I wish the pacing was better? Sure. But I will say this, the final fight scene all in around the Great Divider is actually really nicely done. It's a lot of fun, and, I haven't really sort of thought which is my favorite of the fight scenes, but this one has a really nice sort of verve to it. It keeps it moving, and there's always something going on, and cut from, you know, this to that to this to that. Like Frank, I think, is fighting Half Nelson, I think, and Drac is fighting Half Wit, and Bruce is fighting Albert Alberta. And there's lots of nice cuts. It's a lot of fun that Alberta escapes and ends up running into the room with a female werewolf, I guess, mauls them in some way. It's a lot of fun for the episode. And again, it doesn't feel like the final episode of anything. And I know I see mixed things on this, because like if you look up when the show was on the air, its last episode aired in early September 1977. So the show would have aired four times in full. 13 times 4 is 52 over the course of a year. So, I mean, I think I've said it before, if this were a prime time show, 13 episodes is a failure. Is sadly not always a bomb, but is a failure for whatever reason. Whether it went off the air because no one watched it, or went off the air due to trouble at the network or trouble with the production or whatever, 13 episodes is not a successful primetime show. But it is a successful Saturday morning show, 13 episodes, because you could show them over and over again, right? You know, like the Ghostbusters that aired the year before with Bob Burns, Larry Storch, and Forrest Tucker. They made 15 super cheap episodes of that on video. So like Monster Squad is cheap, but it's on film, so it's got some semblance of production value. Whereas Ghostbusters is shot on video and looks just super duper cheap. Watch the episode with that little piece of hair on top of the screen. It's fun to watch sort of when it's there and when it's not. You can see sort of like, oh no, there's Albert Alberta without the hair up there. That must have been a second day, like fighting Yeah, I guess maybe the fight stuff was done on the second day. Anyway, I forget what I was saying. Something about the show. I like when Bruce goes into jump rope and Albert wants to sort of beat Bruce up. And Alberta looks like she wants to join in and double dutch. And Frank with the beating up half Nelson, knocking him out on the table, putting the little puppy on the ground, putting the club by him and saying, keep an eye on him. A lot of fun stuff. And I even like the uncovered laser gun that shoots out all the all those weird sparks and everything. So anyway, yeah, I mean, was the show a failure? No, I don't think so, because they aired it four times, and, you know, it was shot cheaply, it was shot quickly, it aired four times, it whatever it had to do advertising-wise, I would say it did. And as you know, also many, many shows, Saturday morning shows, 60s, 70s, 80s, only had one season. I would always say, I always look at Hong Kong Phooey. There are people who still know what Hong Kong Phooey is. Hong Kong Phooey only had 16 episodes. You know, when I in the first half of the 80s, my sister and I used to watch the USA with the Cartoon Network, which is on, what was it, 6 to 8 or 6 to 7, Monday through Friday? And that almost entirely consisted of shows like Inside Private Eye and Hong Kong Phooey and Roman Holidays and shows that only ran one season, had 13 to 16 episodes, and they would show them when they were gone. So I think it's just the way Saturday morning shows were done. They, like I said, they would show them four times over the, if there were 13 episodes. Over the course of a year, kids would watch them, kids would get to know, love them, and then, you know, summertime was hit, and most kids would maybe be out and about doing things and wouldn't be able to watch them during the summer. And then when school started up again in September, there'd be a whole new brace of shows. And sometimes shows would appear, but most of the time they didn't. So I say, you know, at the end of the day, to me, it's a successful show. It kind of vanished for many years. And this was actually the first episode I saw. It was on. I read about it somewhere, heard about it somewhere. What did I do? I think it was like one day I read about the show and I went online, and this was the only one that was on YouTube. It was like someone was doing like a lost TV shows kind of thing, and they showed this. And I watched it and thought, oh, that was okay. And then weirdly enough, like 3 months later, the DVD set came out, which I still have right here. When did the set come out? Like 2009 or something? I don't even know. But it's been out for a while now. And so, yeah, the set came out, and then it went out of print, and then it came out again, and that one went out of print. But it's a lovely two-disc set, you know, and I'm sure it was, I wonder if it was probably not shot on 35 mil. I would bet it was probably shot on 16 to save money, and not that, you know, you're watching it Saturday morning, it's kids watching it Saturday morning, hopped up on breakfast cereal, they don't give a... They don't give a crap if it's 16 mil or 35. I would bet it was 16. I'd love it if the negatives existed somewhere, we could get a really nice I mean, we have, right, so they have released some cartoons and Saturday morning shows on nice Blu-ray sets. So I got Johnny Quest. No, Johnny Quest was a prime time. But there are shows. I would love to see a Monster Squad Blu-ray. Anyway, Alberta, fun episode. I like during the closing, as they're all kind of standing around talking, Frank is oiling his knuckles, and then Frank makes a bad joke, and everybody laughs, and it's great. And and it ends with what? Bruce is combing his hair, brushing his hair. Vito Scotti's Albert Alberta. Raymond Singer's half-wit. Phil Diskin is half-Nelson. And it ends, yeah, Bruce is kind of brushing his hair. Walt is reading the newspaper. Dracula is knitting the bottom of his cape. And Frank is oiling his knuckles. And that's the way the show ends, with the freeze frame and everybody laughing at Frank's joke. And I like to think they went on to many, many, many more adventures. But yeah, overall, as I've said, I quite love this show. In one respect, I like the fact that I think the two least episodes were the ones they showed first, because then you can watch those, and to me, like I said, those are the worst, so if you can watch those and get to the end of those and think, that was okay, it just gets better and better. Whereas to sort of, if they had sort of, say, put the Queen Bee as like episode, like Mr. Mephisto, like episode, say, 4, and then Queen Bee is like 9 or 10, they're not dud episodes, they're not bad episodes, I think they're probably same quality basically as the others. I just think they're bad ones to start with. I don't know how you would have started. I mean, maybe Lawrence of Moravia, since that seemed to be the first one. I don't know. But they did it the way they did it, and it ran all year, and they didn't even pull it during. I mean, to me, that's another thing with the success or not of these shows. If the show was so low rated on Saturday morning, they would have taken it off. They wouldn't have played it four times. You know, if it was like, oh my God, nobody watched it, we got a zero rating, they're not going to play it again and again and again. They're going to take it off and replace it with something else. So it must have been popular. As I didn't get to finish the story of the Ghostbusters, the Ghostbusters there. That show was playing in the early 80s where I lived. It was like after 11 o'clock when like the cartoons had ended, and they did like an hour or two of live action stuff. Like they were still showing Captain Marvel and Isis, and they were showing the Ghostbusters. You know, they were showing the Ghostbusters. I mean, that was 6-7 years beforehand. So they could show these things over and over and over again, and kids didn't care. I mean, yeah, I think I knew probably in 1981, 82 if I was watching Ghostbusters, it looked a little weird, like it was older. And you know, watching Captain Marvel or Isis, you go, okay, well, clearly something with the way they're dressed, more like the Brady Bunch than they are the Facts of Life. So you know, there's something a little weird here. But overall, it's great stuff. I really enjoyed the show. I'm glad I finally got to cover it on here with you all. And I will just say just a couple more things before I go. And obviously you can go on YouTube and watch all of these. Some kind soul has put all 13 of them up there. And if you like them, try to get a copy of the set. It's lovely to have the whole thing on DVD and just enjoy it. Although if you leave the main menu on and the volume turned up and you go and do something, you're gonna hear that theme song over and over again. Well, it's a lot of fun. And I didn't realize how is it the most bongo heavy theme song ever. Listen, or whatever those, you know, ba ba ba, those, you know, it's like, wow, Ricky Ricardo's joined in, and it's fantastic. It's funny. This show, Manimal, and one other show were the three shows on Adventure Super Train that I had planned to do with somebody, and for whatever reason they got canceled. And now Manimal, of course, I did a long time ago with the great Charlie Brown and the Mother Effin' Browns. Monster Squad, I did now, and I believe later this year I will be doing the third of them, and I'll also be doing that by myself because it's on a sort of once easy-ish to get, now rare-ish, I think, DVD set. So that'll be fun, and I won't tell you what that show is. I'll just say 80s. It's 1980s. And, oh, the last thing I wanted to say is this fun thing where I have, in when I open up my Monster Squad thing, I have three little trading cards. And they're from the great Toy Ventures magazine, made by the guys who did who do Plaid Stallions. And it's Bruce W. Wolf, it's Drac, it's Frankenstein, it's action figures. Have you seen these? I bet you can go online and find them. On the back it says Monster Squad prototypes. Proposed by Ideal Toy Corporation in 1977, these Monster Squad action figures never saw production. The handmade prototypes, believed lost for over 40 years, surfaced in 2020. So during the pandemic, someone found a couple boxes full of these Monster Squad action figure prototypes. Can you think about that? Action figures? It's funny. I just, a couple of weeks ago, I did a, I was on a Blu-ray commentary with a good friend, and I discussed action figures. I rarely discuss toys and action figures, but now this is twice within a month. So that's cool. Portmanteau man, Portmanteau Dan. Let me go grab the Toy Ventures magazine. I'll be right back. So I'm looking at Toy Ventures magazine. Issue 2, Winter 2021. It has a action figure of a Cyberman from Doctor Who on it. Mego Doctor Who, A Complete Guide, H.R. Puff and Stuff Puppets, Color Farms, Outer Spacemen, a figure called Sloan, Mattel's Godzilla's Gang, and Lost Toys of Monster Squad. And there's an article in here, page 20, Oscillating Vibrations. 10:30 a.m., new Monster Squad, Wax Museum monsters who come to life at night and take orders from a teenage boy. You know, Walt there, Fred Grandy, is that, who was 28 at the time, what, like 2 years after this, he's Gopher on Love Boat, so he's a grown man, and in the summer of 77, he appears on an episode of The Great Fernwood Tonight, where he plays a doctor, I want to say an optometrist or an ophthalmologist who has been prescribing. They just discovered that marijuana helps alleviate glaucoma. And he comes in to tell everyone that if anyone thinks they have glaucoma, just come to him and he can get them really good stuff, whatever they need. He can hook them up. And he said ever since they discovered that marijuana helps glaucoma, he would say, like, I think he says something like, you know, a year ago, you know, one out of every 10 people I treated had glaucoma. Now about 3 out of every 5 do. So that's fun. But it's a good article on there, and clearly I think that the guy who produces Plaid Stallion's guy, he loves Monster Squad. He's a big Monster Squad fan. And yeah, you have the board game, which it's funny. Milton Bradley's Monster Squad board game is the most commonly found item. Despite being wonderfully illustrated, it is a particularly uninspired game to play. Okay, I'm gonna do something real quick. Let me see. What I'm gonna do is this. I'm gonna wrap up this episode, and I'm gonna include this as a sort of little just bonus extra me yakking about a little bit more yakking about Monster Squad, because I think we're gonna wrap it up now. So next time we will be back with episode 4 as broadcast. You know, I keep saying that for a reason, of Partners in Crime, and season 2, episode 3, episode 9 of Max Headroom, and the first episode of a brand new old show. I will give this away. We are staying in the '70s. And it is a guest that we know and love. And it'd be nice to have them return. So I'm just going to leave you there this time. Be good to yourself, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm going to miss Monster Squad. Maybe we can do Drac Pack. Or maybe I can do another episode of Sabrina the Groovy Ghoulies. What do you think about that? Maybe. So be good to yourselves, everyone.
Been returned to their natural habitats, and the Monster Squad are big heroes once again.
And what happened to Albert Alberta, Walt?
Albert Alberta is in jail, Frank.
He went to the men's jail.
And she went to the ladies' jail.
Oh, I guess they were fighting so much they decided to split up.